It's a joy to greet you in the name of the Lord today. I think we're stuck with this mic, so I'll try and discipline myself and hang around here.
You can take it out of the holder.
I can do that, but how many hands? What do you call a Dutch woman without hands? Speechless. It's amazing how much we can wring out of a little document like the Decalogue if we aren't even in it yet. I have a picture up here that illustrates the problem of the rich young ruler of whom we heard this morning, those of you who haven't been to the service yet. This is that guy's problem. He's got to Sinai, but he's never left Egypt. And that's why Jesus says, follow me. Who does Jesus think he is in saying that? Of course, he is Yahweh. The one who said, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. The guy's never been there. And that is his problem. Well, we hopefully we can get through this document today. No promises, but at least the email said we were going to try. If we don't, I mean, if we do, that forces me to make up a new outline for next week. And that's hard work. In any case, here is that. Here, the same problem. Notice they all lack the preamble, which is the most important part of the document. I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Sinai before the Exodus, and that won't work. Another one. Well, actually, this one has it, doesn't it? I am the Lord your God. It does. That's better. But there's still all kinds of things wrong with it that we'll talk about later. Now, in order to clarify what I will be doing in a moment, I have to explain how I number the terms of the Decalogue. They're called the Ten Commandments, the Ten Words. Which are the Ten Words? And of course, in the Reformed tradition, we have a certain way of numbering them. Do I have this on your synopsis? Yes, two approaches to numbering the Decalogue. Those of you who are visiting, there are a couple of copies left over here, and you can see the Reformed tradition on the left-hand side and the Catholic and Lutheran tradition on the right-hand side. And then, of course, you have the Jewish tradition, which is different still. But in any case, these are the two main possibilities for us. And I would like to spend 5 minutes arguing for the right side of the sheet. I know that some of us think the Reformers were absolutely infallible in all that they did, but this is a small matter of how we number them. There are fundamental issues at stake if we number it the way the Reformers did. And so, how fundamental, we'll see. Anyhow, why do I number them like the Lutherans and the Catholics? First, turn to Exodus chapter 20. This is where the issues start. The ambiguity of Exodus 20, verse 17. And this is what probably got us going with a Reformed numbering, or this is what precipitated that kind of numbering. Look at verse 17. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. And then, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or male servant, or female servant, or ox, or donkey, or anything belonging to your neighbor. You've got the same verb twice. And it looks like that first one is a statement of principle, and the second one is exposition. In which case, house actually means household. You shall not covet your neighbor's household. And then notice where he puts, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. Along with
your neighbor's male servant or female servant or ox or donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Guys, what do we do with that?
Your wife is not an object.
Your wife is not a piece of property like the rest. And of course, there's a widespread opinion out there in the academic world that in the Old Testament, wives were merely property. They had no rights, no honor, no dignity, just property. And so you could dispose of them, treat them any way you want. Unfortunately, I was going to say gentlemen, but that's an oxymoron then. Men. This is how we often treat them. This one is quite ambiguous. On the one hand, it looks like the word house, household, is a heading for the rest. And so it's assumed that that's one command. Well, if that's one command, then you have to count backwards and find nine more. And you're forced to divide one command into two, or you land up with nine. And so what happens is we go all the way back to the first one. If you look at the synoptic sheet that I have here, if you go back to the first one, we split them. You shall have no other gods before me. That's one. And the second one is that you shall not make for yourself any graven image. On the assumption that these are then two commands. One is about no other gods. And the other is about not making any image of Yahweh. That's how it's commonly interpreted. All right, next thing to think about here. The modifications in Deuteronomy 5. Let's go to the last command. Very interesting. And you have this, I think... Yes, you do actually have it here. Right at the bottom of this sheet... Notice what we've got in verse 21 on the left-hand side, and 21. Is that right? They're the same number? They are. Notice what happens here. In the left, verse 21, you shall not covet your neighbor's... I've missed something. You shall not covet your... Oh, no, both of those are off Deuteronomy. That's the problem. Turn to the other sheet. This one. Two approaches to numbering. Are they the same? Mine are the same. Are yours the same? Here we go. Synoptic versions. That's it. Now go to the bottom one. 17. That's right. I knew the numbers weren't the same. What's going on here? Look at the bottom of the left-hand column, Exodus. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet. In Hebrew, it's the same word. Then what happens in Deuteronomy, he starts, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. That's first. Keeping the old word for covenant, covet. And then, you shall not desire, he changes the verb. Your neighbor's house. And then he adds field. Why?
Another object.
It's another object. And so now that's a clue as to how to interpret house. House and field. Notice what we've got then are three pairs. You shall not covet your neighbor's house and field. Male or female servant, ox or donkey. Three pairs. And that's a clue that we should actually not treat house as household. But it is the property of the house as a counterpart to the field. Houses at home, fields are out there. So those are a couple of things that he does. In this way, Moses is reciting the Decalogue. We've said that before. He's not reading it because he makes a few very significant changes. This is only one, but it's highly significant. He is reciting it so that the people get the theological point of the document.
to which we will get in a moment. But in any case, it is very clear that in the Deuteronomy version, these are two separate commands. Let's go to the next one. The reference is to God in the first person. If you look on the left-hand side of the column, well, look on both sides, actually, Exodus, if you separate, you shall have no other gods besides me, first person. How far does that first person continue? You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that's in heaven or earth, that's on the earth beneath, or that's the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord, your God, am an impassioned God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands to those who love me and keep my commandments. Notice it's all first person. Ties it all together. When you get to what I call the second command, you shall not carry in vain the name. It doesn't say my name. It says the name of the Lord. So that little stylistic thing ties these first two, what you call the first two, together. The content of one and two by your numbering. What is the first one about? You shall have no other gods besides me. The second part of that, verses 3-6, is simply an unpacking of what that means. What does it mean to have no other gods? It means to make no other gods. So, you shall have no other gods beside you. What kind of gods could we imagine? You shall not make for yourself a carved image, not of the Lord, but of any other thing. And the likeness of anything that's in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or that's in water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them. Oh, which leads us to Deuteronomy 4:15-16. Turn back the page, Deuteronomy. We talked about this last spring in chapter 4. Remember verses 9, verses 12. Let's see, where shall we pick it up here? Verse 15. So watch yourselves carefully, since you didn't see any form of the Lord the day the Lord spoke to you in Mount Horeb from it, that you do not act corruptly and make a graven image for yourself in the form of any figure, the likeness of male or female, the likeness of any animal that's on the earth, the likeness of the winged bird that flies in the sky, or of anything that creeps on the ground, of any fish in the water of the sea, and beware that you don't lift up your eyes to the heaven and see the sun, moon, and the stars and put them alongside God. These are competitors to God that you might create for yourself, or, in the case of the sun, moon, and stars, simply, they are created beings, assign them that kind of status. So, this is what we're talking about, competitors to God. God, this is what's unique about Israelite religion. Other religions don't mind if you worship other gods. They assume you will. In Babylon, there were 8 temples to all the big gods. So long as you worship Marduk as central. So, what else? The reference to Elkanah. I think we've talked about this a little bit with some of you. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, Yahweh, your God, am a... But the translation we have is jealous God. But of course, if you recall, the word doesn't actually mean jealousy the way we use the word as a synonym for envy. This is fired up God. Impassioned. Passionate. It is the word that describes the legitimate emotion of a man if somebody is messing with his wife in Proverbs. And of course, what happens at Sinai is a marriage. God entered into covenant relationship with Israel, which is a marriage relationship. And any god that messes with that relationship gets him fired up. The interesting thing is when this kind of language is used of God, it is always in the context of idolatry, other gods, not images of God, of Yahweh. always other gods, which ties it to, you shall have no other gods besides me. This is God's response to those who do. Then you have the plural suffixes in verse, what have we got? In Deuteronomy, verse 10, you shall not bow down to them. If you call this number two, you have no antecedent. Of course, you can't have a... Those of you who are my students, yeah? You can't have a retrospective pronoun in a paragraph without identifying that to which that pronoun refers in that same paragraph, in the opening sentence or whatever. You have to have an antecedent. And if you number it the way our Reformed friends did, you shall not make for yourself, you shall not bow down to them or serve them. Well, where is the them? Where's the plural? Carved image is singular. Likeness of anything in heaven is singular. Where's the plural?
Gods.
You shall have no other gods. You shall not bow down to them or prostrate yourselves before them or serve them. So the plural suffixes. And then the parallels in the last two statements, as we've already noted in Deuteronomy, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, you shall not desire your neighbor's house. And Jewish tradition, although they do number them differently, it's interesting what they do. Somebody said before, this is upside down, might as well be, doesn't matter. It's actually backwards and upside down. In any case, this is the Leningrad Codex, which is the basis of, I didn't bring my big Hebrew Bible, the basis of all liturgical texts in the Jewish tradition these days. Until now, they're working on the Aleppo Codex, which will probably replace this. But notice what they've done. Trust me, this is the beginning. I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you up. Can't you read that? Out of the land of Egypt. And it goes all the way, and there's the first break. Just before, you shall not bear the name of the Lord your God in vain. There's the first break. So they're counting it as one paragraph. Is there any...
So why did the Reformers change it?
I rest my case. I don't know why they did it, but it is at least 500 years old now, and it is very deeply ingrained, not only in the church but in the academy. If I ever write or give a lecture on these kinds of things, I always have to be careful to explain I'm using the proper numbering. Because the standard is the Reformed numbering all over the place, and it's in your translations, it's in your commentaries, and but in any case, slightly off base. It makes a difference because of how you then interpret what we used to call the second commandment. Because if you do that, it invites you to interpret the second command as a prohibition on making images of the Lord, which is how I grew up thinking about this. So you have two commands. Number one is against idolatry, and the other one is against making images of the Lord. There was a hand here.
Yeah. Let's go back to the Jewish way for a minute.
Yes, yes.
Now, I recognize I am the Lord your God is probably prologue normally, but... Yeah. Seems like empirically that you might put in a different content even though you continue to use the form, so that clearly is the first commandment.
Well, see, you notice here how the Jewish one starts. I am the Lord your God is a part of the first command. It's not a preamble set apart. So they include that preamble, and that's why calling this the ten words is helpful, because as it turns out, the first and most important word isn't even a command. It's a statement of gospel truth. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. How stupid it would be for you then to go to other gods. So that's an implication of the gospel, as is everything else in this document. Any other exhortations? Yes, ma'am. No dumb question. Well, you have to force them into 10, because this thing is called the 10 words, 3 or 4 different times. And so that's why if you look at the Reformed numbering, there are 10 commands. But they do that by splitting the last one.
By combining
them. Yeah, by combining the last one. Otherwise you'd have 11. Yes. So. Yes, sir.
I presume the Jewish tradition used a lot because this was written on tablets.
Yes.
I mean, there must be some long memory of that. What did the Lord write on the tablets?
The whole thing. Oh, remember.
But there was some way those were written and split.
But they weren't split.
Okay, you think it was one.
We have 2 tablets with identical content.
They didn't put the Roman numerals on.
And they didn't put the Roman
numerals. We're looking for those Roman numerals.
You know, and with all due respect, our pastor this morning referred to the first tablet. Did you hear that?
Yes.
Did you notice? Hey, that's a long-standing tradition. Goes all the way back to Philo, and it's in Calvin, and it's all over the place. But it just simply means that by the time of Philo, we forgot the significance of 2 tablets. Which is to say, each party to the covenant needs a copy of the document. So they always did. And so the whole thing. So in my view, it doesn't affect where we divide the 2 tablets, because I don't divide them. We've got 2 identical copies. One reminds God not to back off on this covenant commitment. And the other one reminds Israel what they've signed on to. So, all right, let's go on. Enough of that complicated stuff.
Why does God need a reminder?
I think it's for our benefit. Why does God put the rainbow in the sky, Genesis 9, and then the text says, when I see the rainbow, I will remember. Well, why does he tell us that that's his significance to the rainbow? To reassure us that he won't forget. It's a pastoral thing. God is a kind shepherd, giving us reasons to have confidence in him, telling us that he's putting a string on his finger. So that he won't, or he's writing it on his hand, whatever. And that's, I find that very reassuring. God doesn't need to. God don't forget. But of course, it reminds us that God doesn't forget. All right, let's go on. Now we're in the text. Who's the addressee? To whom is this document? For whom is this document written? Is it? Well,
whom I brought out of Egypt.
Yes, whom I brought out of Egypt. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. Does every Israelite have a wife? Well, the way our culture is going, it could be. You shall not desire your neighbor's house. Does every Israelite have a house? You shall not desire his field. Does every Israelite have a field, or a male servant, or a female servant, an ox or a donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor? This is critical.
if we want to figure out the point of the document. Who is the addressee? Who has a wife? Who has... Oh, look at the Sabbath one. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. You shall not do any work. You or your son... Well, let's be more specific. Who has sons?
People.
A father. Good.
Mother.
Or your daughter. Who has servants? The head of a household. Or who has oxen and donkey and sojourners living in his house, male servants and female servants, that they may all rest with you. And who is tempted to go and mess with his neighbor's wife? An adulterer. The specific addressee is an adult male who has property, who is the head of a household. Wow. What difference does that make in how we read the document?
Women don't have to follow it.
Cool. Women don't have to follow it. Yes, back there. It totally stresses the adult male in the household and stresses him out. So what's the potential problem that it's addressing? You shall not steal. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not murder. And if you keep the Sabbath, be sure your whole household keeps the Sabbath. When we lived in Minnesota, we had wonderful neighbors right next door. He was East Indian in origin, and she was, she was Lutheran. I think she was German Lutheran, but in any case, a wonderful family. And we had trouble at one point with water coming off his lot and washing out our yard. So we decided to do a joint project together. We put up a retaining wall and actually made it quite attractive. It can be done. And so we finished it on late Sunday afternoon. Sunday, I had to go and preach, and as we were shutting down for the evening, he said, "Well, you go to church tomorrow, and you pray for me, and I'll clean up." And my response was, "Not on my yard, you won't." I mean, it's well and good for the head of the household to keep the Sabbath, but he can still then let all the servants go and work. And he said, "Before God, I'm keeping the Sabbath." What's the problem? The potential problem for?
Corruption
of power. Precisely. This is fundamental to the message of the book of Deuteronomy, which at every turn is reining in the potential of people with power to abuse it. Whether it's the king, chapter 17, or actually in this text, the head of a household. This is our problem. And so when you read the document this way now, it turns out to be a remarkable document. Which, what's the objective of the document? To rein in the potential for a person with power to abuse. In Deuteronomy 17, you may set a king over yourselves, but he shall not multiply for himself horses, for himself women, for himself silver and gold. That's the problem. We think that the community exists for us. and we exploit other people in our interests. But this is what the king shall do for himself. He shall write for himself a copy of this Torah, and it shall be with him like a pendant, and he shall read it as long as he sits on the throne, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God. Notice he doesn't read it for other people. But that he may fear the Lord, that his heart be not lifted up above his countrymen. Then he will live long on the throne. All over the book of Deuteronomy is about reigning in abuse of power. Changes everything. Let's see how this works. The objective. Well, here we have a synopsis of the first two commands. And actually, in Exodus and Deuteronomy, they're exactly the same, aren't they? No difference. This is what some people call the first tablet. You don't. Moses simply repeats this one. But let's go here. I actually think this, the Decalogue, may be the earliest Bill of Rights in human history. We think the Magna Carta was a great step forward, and we think our Constitution was a great step forward. And now these days, almost every country has some kind of Bill of Rights, and we think we are very civilized. I call this a Bill of Rights. But you will notice whose rights it's protecting. And it's not the people in power. Contrary to David Kleins, who has an essay to which I'm responding on. My essay is called Reading the Decalogue Right to Left, which is how Hebrew reads. That's the right direction. Yeah. The title of his paper is Reading the Decalogue Left to Right. And his question is, whose interests are being served? And he argues it is the head of the household who is out to protect his property. So you protect your property from other people stealing it. And all kinds. He has it exactly upside down. What are these rights? The first one. The first three in the Exodus version, the first two in the Deuteronomy version, speak of the Lord's rights. You shall have no other gods besides me. Make no other images, whatever. What right? The Lord has the right to exclusive allegiance. Not only because he has triumphed over all gods, Exodus 12:12, but especially because he has graciously redeemed Israel, brought her to himself, and entered into a covenant relationship with them. But of course, this is not unlike Assyrian kings or Hittite kings. This is not the Lord imposing power and demanding you respect it. It is a gracious invitation to acknowledge his grace. The Lord has the right, by virtue of creation and by virtue of our redemption, to our exclusive allegiance. You shall have no other gods besides me. Love the Lord your God with all your heart. We'll come back to this in next year. Deuteronomy 6:4. Heart, and with all your being, and with all your stuff. My paraphrase. Number two, you shall not bear the name of the Lord your God. Now, we translate it, take the name of the Lord your God in vain. But of course, the verb isn't take. The verb is carry. I was going to bring a baseball cap. I forgot to put it in my briefcase. We wear names of all sorts these days. Some of you wear socks, hats. I don't. Sorry about that. Some of you wear Cubs hats. I don't. I wear a Twins hat. Sorry. We lived there for 12 years. You're free to do that. But why do we wear hats like that? I mean, here on this campus, people are wearing Wheaton shirts. And I was going to wear a tie with my Liverpool logo on it. Why do we do that? It's a mark of identification. There are actually two things involved in bearing the name. In the ancient world, I know we're not going to get done. In the ancient world, if you need a new pot,
You go down to the potter and you tell the potter, I need a new pot. Would you make me a new pot? Before he fires up that pot, he asks, should I put your name on it? L? I think we've done this before. Plus your name, and in my case, it would be something like this. That means belonging to. It's a mark of ownership. In the ancient world, they branded slaves with the names of their owners. In Mesopotamian temples, temple servants were branded with the name of the god, or the symbol of the god whose servants they were. Isaiah 44. Did we read that text at one point? I forget what context we've been, but turn to Isaiah 44. Isaiah 44, verses 4 and 5. I will pour my spirit on your offspring, my blessing on your descendants, and they will spring up among the grass like poplars. He's talking about the restoration of Israel. This one will say, I belong to Yahweh. And that one will call on the name of Jacob, which is, he's identifying with the people who belong to Yahweh. And another will write on his hand, and I should do it on the right hand because you wouldn't do it on the left, belonging to Yahweh. With that L.
Can you write that, what you just said, I wrote on your hand?
Can't spell it. It's such a hard word to spell. Belonging to the Lord. That's the brand. And of course, there are two things about that. One, it marks ownership. But two, it also advertises. For if you were a king in the ancient world and you went down to the potter and asked for a pot, what kind of pot do you expect he'd make for you, the king? A pretty good one, because you want that pot to declare to the world your glory and your splendor. So that to bear the name means to advertise to the world who our owner is. Well, now let's talk about what does it mean to bear it in vain? Of course, we tend to think of this in terms of cussing, and but there are lots of other ways in which we bear the name. We bring the Lord our shopping lists, and then we end it and say, in Jesus' name. When you've not been interested in Jesus' name at all in that list, you've just been interested in yourself. Your prayer is in effect. My kingdom come, my will be done, and we're trying to get the genie in the Aladdin's lamp to come and do our bidding. It's just a magical thing. I think that's vainly using the name. But there are lots of other ways. We do it flippantly in our curses. And I'm shocked. I'm not shocked when the world does this. But I'm shocked when I hear Christians say, oh my God. As an expletive. That's the cheap use of the name of God. In my understanding, it's sacrilege and blasphemy. But I don't think we've touched on the basics yet. There's another way in which this is done. My colleague argues that it has to do with using the name of the Lord in curses, damning people by using curses, damning you, or whatever else, in formal things. It was a common practice. But I think this is all part of it, but I don't think it's at the heart of it. What does it mean to carry, wear the name of the Lord in vain?
Is it an example of putting one of those fish on your car and then driving poorly?
Yes! Is it putting a fish on your car and driving badly? Honk if you love Jesus, and then your road rage overtakes you. Of course!
It's claiming to have the brand of God on you and living as if you belong to Baal. And I tell you, the implications of this are all over the place. The rich young ruler was all about fertility religion, and he couldn't let go. Anytime we're about our well-being, it's about wearing the name of Baal. Or claiming to be the Lord's and acting like the world. When we were in Louisville before we moved up here, I hadn't had a new car for a long time. We tended to drive these things into the ground. Finally, we got a new car. I still miss that car. Ellen doesn't. But I'll never forget, shortly after we got that new car, I put on it a vanity plate.
Chesed.
I had just put on my plate that day, and I was driving home from work down Brownsboro Road, and all of a sudden there's a cherry, a flashing cherry. And he stops me and he says, "Do you realize how fast you were driving?" He said, "I have no idea." But it was a new car. I hadn't had a new car for a long time. And the sense of speed, it's totally illusory. As far as I was concerned, it's 35 mile an hour zone. And that's what I was driving. No, you weren't. Do you know what my first response was? Oh, dear. Look at my license plate. I said, here is one who claims this as his motto, who receives the chesed from God and lives that chesed. No, I didn't. I was bearing the name in vain, misrepresenting the person we claim as our owner, as our Savior, our Redeemer, the Creator of all, and then living as if we're really governed by the gods of this world, misrepresenting God. So that it isn't images of God that are the biggest threat to God's proper representation. You know, so if you try and create an image of Yahweh, anything you do is going to be understatement, infinitely blasphemous because it's infinitely understated. But that's, God has his images all over the place. Every human being is an image of God. And those of us who are redeemed are twice imaged because we now bear the stamp of his name. Of course, this, if you have a sermon coming on, this carries over all the way into the New Testament, to 1 Peter and everywhere else. This is, if you are a Christian claiming the name of Christ, if you suffer for that name, Peter talks about it, be sure it's not as a jerk. We have a lot of people who are, you know, they claim to be so pious and then they get mistreated and they think, "I'm suffering for Jesus." No, you're not. You're suffering because you're a jerk. And this happens in all our worlds. So that if you've got a motto in your home or in your office, that we live by that. Well, God has the right to proper representation. He has chosen his mirrors. See, Israel's problem was they forgot this. We've read this before, chapter 26, verse 16. Let's go to verse 19. He will set you high above all the nations which he has made for praise, fame, and honor. Not your praise and your fame and your honor, but the Lord's praise, fame, and honor, that you shall be a consecrated people belonging to him as he has spoken. And then over to chapter 28, verse 9, the Lord will establish you as a holy people for himself as he swore you. So all the peoples of the earth will see, my translation has, that you are called by the name of the Lord. Translate it literally, it's that the name of the Lord is read on you. Well, if the name of the Lord is read on you, where is the name? It's written on you. And that's why when God's people live in sin, they defile the name. They bring shame to the name. But when God's people are flourishing as humble recipients of his grace, they bring honor to the name. Our time is gone again. We're into the second. Well, if you think we've covered more territory, the third command. Think optimistically. The second command. We'll come back next week. The Sabbath, which is number 3, not number 4. And of course, now, you look at the Exodus version, and you look at the Deuteronomy version, they're quite different. Ooh, the black is the same, but then reds are addition, blues are alterations. We've changed it. Raises interesting questions. At the beginning of Deuteronomy 4, Moses had said, "You shall not add to the word that I am giving you, nor subtract from it." Well, what in the world is he doing? We'll let you stew over that this week. You figure it out, and come back next week with an answer. Let's pray. Gracious Father, open our eyes to your grace and soften our hearts to receive it. Forgive us for misrepresenting you so badly in the way we do our work. We are shoddy, careless. In the way we relate to our neighbors, we are insensitive. In the way in which we treat the person at the checkout counter, we're brutal and short. In so many ways, we plead your forgiveness. What an honor it is to bear the name of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Remind us of that honor daily. And help us to honor you, our Father in heaven. Hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come. Your will be done in my life as it is in heaven. For yours is the kingdom and the power.